KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education in Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is May 28th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Josie Huang, filling in for A. Martinez. Happy Friday. I hope you can all enjoy the long, long weekend ahead. It'll be a little cool for a Memorial Day in Southern California, though there should be some sun. But before you grab your sunscreen and run out the door, stick with us for a little while. We'll have some great ideas for ways you can spend the next 3 days. Plus, we'll introduce you to a new way of thinking about self-defense. It's called asphalt anthropology.
What are behaviors that a bad guy would be exhibiting? What are environmental factors that you can be looking out for?
Cultivating street smarts, that's coming up in about 30 minutes. But we start as we do most Fridays with politics. The Speaker of the House gets under the president's skin yet again. Meanwhile, in California, a bill that would tighten laws around police use of force gains traction in the legislature, while Governor Gavin Newsom zeroes in on homelessness. We'll review it all during State of Affairs, our weekly look at Golden State politics. Joining us today is Jack Pitney. He's the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Hello, Jack.
Good afternoon.
Also with us is Carla Marinucci, Senior Editor for Politico's California Playbook. Thanks for coming on the show, Carla.
Hey, Josie, good to be with you.
First, I'd like to talk to you two about the controversial use of force bill that appears now to be almost certainly going to become law. AB 392 would essentially create a much tougher legal standard to determine whether force was justified in police shootings. In about 15 minutes, we're going to dig into this potential effect that it would have on law enforcement here with one of our reporters, Frank Stoltz. But tell us, Carla, what hurdles did the bill clear yesterday? Why is it more or less a sure thing now?
Well, Josie, you know, this bill came in the wake of those disturbing headlines out of Sacramento with the death last year of Stephon Clark. He was the unarmed Sacramento man killed by police after they mistook a cell phone for him holding a gun. And so there's been months of negotiation over efforts to put California sort of in the forefront of curtailing this deadly use of force and the recurring headlines. And now comes this bill, which is really being hailed as one of the strongest in the nation. And what it does is mandate that police may only use deadly force when necessary in the defense of human life. And that is a tougher standard than the current one, which says police can shoot when doing so is reasonable. What made the difference here is the bill's author, Assemblywoman Shirley Weber. She struggled. She had to find common ground with law enforcement, but she got their backing. That was a key factor in the success of this whole thing here. And supporters say that this law is going to save lives by actually setting new standards for police on the use of force.
Yeah, I hear a couple of things here that there was some real a lot of legwork done by the bill's sponsor, but also there was the driving force that rose out of the Stephon Clark case. Jack, the governor has been supportive of this legislation as well. Do you expect him to sign this into law?
Yes, there's very little doubt that he'll sign it, and this will be a significant move on his part.
And how important is it for Newsom to rubber stamp this?
Very important, and symbolically, it's huge, because if you look at California, say, 30 years ago, the late 80s, early 90s, the big political movement was tough on crime. Dianne Feinstein, running for governor in 1990, bragged about her support for the death penalty, and all the politicians wanted to be tough on crime. Now, 30 years later, the crime rate is a lot lower. California has moved to the left politically, and this bill is a sign of both movements.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to hear more about this bill, which is AB 392, later on in the show. But I want to move on to another issue Governor Newsom is also getting behind. Here he is talking on Tuesday, about homelessness.
This defines the state of California. I'm in Grass Valley. Meet the mayor. What's your number one issue? Homelessness. I'm in Riverside. Mayor, what's your number one issue? Homelessness. I'm in Fresno. What's your number one issue? Homelessness. It's not Santa Monica. It's not San Jose. It's not San Francisco. It's not LA. It's not Oakland any longer. This is the issue that ultimately defines our failure as a society.
All right, Carla, at that press conference, Newsom talked about a task force he was forming. It was first announced in February. Now he's added L.A. County Supervisor Mark Ridley-Thomas as co-chairman, along with Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg. Now, how has this task force been received up in Sacramento in political circles?
I think there's some relief that Gavin Newsom has taken a very different tactic than Jerry Brown, who really didn't talk this problem up much, Josie. And Newsom is really taking it head on because it has become the most visible problem in California cities from border to border. I was at that press conference in Oakland this week, and what struck me was the governor's acknowledgement that a lot of money has been thrown at this problem. And of course, his budget proposes $1 billion for it. But the fact is that Newsom said he wants to do something differently now, not just issue another white paper or another blue ribbon committee. He wants to make a serious effort at finding the best practices around the state that have made a dent in the problem. And I think that is the difference. He had this press conference at an Oakland facility where homeless people are assigned counselors and case managers. And according to Libby Schaaf, the mayor there, 80% of them who move in, 80% of them who come to this facility move into permanent housing after. So that's the kind of solutions he's looking for. And he tagged two people right on the front lines, Daryl Steinberg, the mayor of Sacramento, and, of course, Mark Ridley-Thomas, to be, on the issue and to come up with solutions within a couple of months. So we're going to watch this very closely and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Jack, as Carla was saying, the governor is putting the money where his mouth is, and cities like L.A. are doing that as well. They're, putting millions towards fighting homelessness. The problem is, though, that things seem to be getting worse, and we're expecting not great numbers at all when LA releases its homeless population numbers next week. So with everything the governor is trying to champion and budget for, everything from education to wildfire prevention, how important should homelessness be for him? Should it rank at the top? What do you think?
Rank very near the top. He's taking a very smart approach, trying to find out what works, not simply throwing money at the problem, but actually trying to solve the problem. And it's very important. First of all, it's very visible. Just about any freeway off-ramp, you're going to run into a homeless person who needs help. And it's a pay now or pay later kind of problem, because if we don't address this, the longer people are out on the street, they're going to have health problems, they're going to be crime victims, all sorts of things are going to happen to them, and that's a tragedy for them, and it's a cost to society. So it's something he has to address.
Yeah. Carla, I'm going to move from the underpasses of, freeways in L.A. to D.C. now. I want to ask you about the fight. Another fight, I should say.
Oh, yes.
That erupted right. Earlier this week between Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and President Trump. I can already picture it, but please set the scene for us.
Wow, this was a jaw-dropping moment, Josie, after Nancy Pelosi suggested that the president was involved in a cover-up, talked about maybe he needed an intervention, said she was going to pray for him and his family. That set President Trump off in a way that, I guess it's starting to happen quite regularly. This is about the third time.
Does anybody get under his skin the way she does?
I don't think so. I think you have to say in the big game of political poker, she has managed to do it. She's come out with a winning hand time and time again. And in a way, this is a mother of five, a grandmother of nine. She's kind of been the Steph Curry of the three-pointer in getting under his skin. And in the way she does it is kind of, just basically talking to him almost like he's somebody who needs a timeout. That set him off. And the fact is, at the end, I think Republicans were left, just scratching their heads saying, what happened here? Because she came out a winner in that fight. And this isn't the first time that that's happened.
Well, Jack, I want to ask what you think. Do you think Pelosi came out as a winner? Because you're left with a president who's refusing to work with Democrats like herself on infrastructure or really anything at all until they agree to stop investigating him. I mean, is there any movement here, even with her seeming like she has the winning hand?
Yeah, I think Carl is absolutely right. On the optics, she absolutely won. Also on the merits, Trump is saying, well, Congress can't work on two tracks. That is provably historically false. 1973. Watergate investigation in the United States Senate, Watergate all over the place. And yet Congress was able to pass historic legislation such as the War Powers Act, the Endangered Species Act, and more than I could name in the next half hour.
Wow. So you mentioned Watergate. Well, what's all going on now, of course, is talk about impeachment within the Democratic Party. And more Democrats seem to be calling for the impeachment process to get kicked off against the president. But the speaker has been resistant to the idea. Where might this debate go?
A lot's going to depend on what kind of information comes out. And here, some of the information's going to come out not of Washington, but out of Albany, because the New York State Legislature has passed legislation that would enable prosecution of people who have been pardoned by Trump, but also, perhaps more important, potentially give congressional committees access to his state tax returns, which will have pretty much the same information as his federal returns. And who knows what kind of breadcrumbs are going to be lurking in those documents.
All right. Well, stay tuned for that. But before I let you go, I have a question for you both as closer to home. I'm talking about in your own homes, as you're both parents. I want to ask you about another bill in the legislature. This one would push back school start times for middle and high schoolers. I know you have a high schooler right now, Jack. We've seen it before. It was vetoed before by former Governor Jerry Brown. Carla, what's going on here?
Well, this one speaks to every parent who's had trouble getting the kids out of bed in the dark, you know, get them up to go to school, which is just about everybody out there, I'm sure. Uh-huh. And the bill by State Senator Anthony Portantino is getting closer to becoming law. It would require the state's middle schools start after 8 a.m. and high schools after 8:30. And why? Because government research from the CDC, no less, says that California's average start time is bad for their health. This is backed by the American Academy of Pediatrics, the California Medical Association. There were opponents to it. It was a little bit controversial. The California Teachers Association talked about, transportation costs rising. And some Republicans said, look, this is better left to local control and may disrupt family schedules. But the fact is, a popular idea with a lot of parents to push those back, everybody kind of agrees more sleep is better for kids. They do better in school.
Jack, more sleep better for kids, better for parents too? What do you think?
Well, my daughter had this as a middle school debate topic, and I listened to her preparation. I am totally into both sides
she
of the issue.
She supported.
Oh yeah,
the late start. Okay,
there you go.
And the pro side is a lot more popular among middle schoolers. I'll tell you that. I mean, the serious case against is this could be disruptive for parental schedules, particularly parents who have shifts that wouldn't allow them to adjust to this.
Yeah, I wonder what would happen there. But as for myself, as a late riser, I'm always hoping my kids will sleep in. And when I hear them go, Mommy, that's when I groan. That's it for me. Jack Pitney is the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. And Carla Marinucci is Senior Editor for Politico's California Playbook. Thanks to you both. And have a great holiday weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Josie.
We've got more coming up on Take Two this hour. As you've heard, the state is poised to change the way it regulates use of force. Are police officers going to see more prosecutions? That's a fear of theirs. Our public safety reporter, Frank Stoltz, will be joining me in studio. He'll break it down for us. Also, more revelations in the sex crime case of the USC gynecologist. Stay with us to hear more. Back with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang, filling in for A. Martinez. As we mentioned earlier, the state legislature appears on the verge of passing a bill that would toughen the legal standard for when a police officer can use deadly force. That's after backers of the bill reached a compromise with police organizations that had strongly opposed the original version. Here to explain it all to us is KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Josie.
Frank, what would this bill do exactly?
Well, it would change the long-held standard that gives officers wide leeway to use deadly force if they have a reasonable fear that they or others are in imminent danger. It's kind of a vague standard. Officers can perceive a threat and legally kill someone even if the person was unarmed and not a threat. For instance, if someone had a cell phone in a dark alley, for example. It's been the standard since 1989. It was a Supreme Court ruling. And California Assemblywoman Shirley Weber proposed a bill that would allow an officer to shoot only when it is necessary. So essentially changing the standard from reasonable to necessary. The original version defined as necessary as meaning that given the totality of the circumstances, an officer would conclude that there was no reasonable alternative to the use of deadly force. That generated strong opposition, as you can imagine, from rank and file cops, as well as chiefs and county sheriffs. Virtually the entire policing industry opposed it. They said it would result in officers hesitating to shoot during confrontations with violent suspects, and that hesitation could be deadly for the officers.
There was a compromise, and it seems like it was effectively able to change hearts and minds. What's different in this new version?
Yeah, the new version says officers can only use deadly force when necessary, but it no longer provides specific definitions of what necessary means. Police groups said it would have been virtually impossible to train to any specific definition. They pointed out there are myriad options as officers for officers at any given moment. You can imagine approaching a scene. There's lots of different ways they can go about apprehending or confronting a suspect. And trying to define them and exhausting all of those options to get to the necessary standard would have been unrealistic and, again, dangerous. So it'll be up to first prosecutors and then judges and juries to decide what's necessary as the law begins to be implemented. The bill still allows prosecutors to look at events leading up to a shooting. Did the officer use de-escalation techniques? Did he or she use less lethal force like beanbag shotguns or a taser? But it's not presented as a checklist where they have to go through each before getting to deadly force. It's more just possibilities, something to consider.
So, Frank, how did this even come up? How did this even become a bill? Talk us through how this all got started.
Well, I mean, it really has its roots in the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014,
okay.
Which, you know, sparked the national uproar over police shootings, particularly of African-American men. Lots of news stories, lots of coverage. And then the shooting of Stephon Clark in Sacramento, right in the lawmaker's backyard, you know, miles from the Capitol. He was an African-American killed unarmed. He was suspected of breaking into cars, not a major crime. And local prosecutors decided officers were justified in shooting the 22-year-old father of two. So it seems lawmakers really could not ignore that shooting. Something had to be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are someone who lives and breathes policing. For you, what are the interesting parts of this bill?
Well, significantly, officers and sheriff's deputies' conduct leading up to a shooting would be considered when determining if the shooting was legal, as I mentioned before. But now the conduct of the suspect is also going to be considered. And also, not just the moment of the pulling of the trigger. In other words, up until now, an officer could do anything and everything wrong up until the moment he confronted you, if you grabbed for the gun, even if you had created the situation as an officer, you were justified in shooting because in the end, somebody grabbed for the gun. Now you can consider whether or not his tactics leading up to it sort of created the situation where he had to shoot. And police groups cheered the addition. They've always said suspects, too, should be considered. Their actions should be considered. And that's now part of the bill. So what suspects do will be considered in determining whether or not an officer acted legally and whether or not criminal charges should be filed against him.
Now, something police were worried about and had this was something debated, I think, throughout the discussion of this bill is whether we were going to see more prosecutions of police officers over shootings. If this bill does become law, as it seems like it will, do you think this is going to happen?
Well, the ACLU's director of police practices says he does not expect an avalanche of prosecutions. Prosecutors have not charged a lot of cops in the past, not just because they dealt with a law that gave officers lots of leeway, that 1989 Supreme Court ruling, but because they partner with city police officers and county sheriff's deputies every day to put criminals away. They have a very close relationship. And critics have long said that relationship is too cozy. You know, only two LA officers have been charged in the past 18 years. And DAs across the state have said they'll file cases when they think they can win. And that depends on evidence, but also on juries. So it's unclear if prosecutors will use the new law to prosecute because it's a somewhat weaker bill than the original bill. that doesn't include the specific definitions. And it'll be interesting to see if the DA uses it to try to prosecute cops.
Well, the most important question, I imagine, for all parties involved is, will this bill result in fewer actual shootings?
Well, that's interesting. You know, according to the Justice Department, police officers killed 172 Californians in 2017, the latest statistics that we have. Of those who let's see, more than two-thirds were people of color. Of those who were completely unarmed when killed by police, the three-quarters were people of color. So the statistics are troubling, to say the least. Now, when Seattle implemented some new standards with similar elements, they did see a drop in shootings. LAPD instituted similar practices, requiring de-escalation, mandating more scenario-based training, deploying more less lethal weapons more often. And they did see a drop in shootings. So this, you know, a lot of people are predicting will result in a drop of drop in shootings. I should add, police groups moved from opposing the bill to becoming neutral on it. So they're not hugely enthused by it, but they're not opposing it anymore.
All right. Thank you very much, Frank, for this update. That's KPCC's Frank Stoltz filling us in on the bill in Sacramento that would toughen the standard for when police officers can use deadly force. University of Southern California gynecologist George Tyndall preyed on Asian students and showed signs of psychopathy. That's according to a confidential report made public this week. This came after the LA Times filed a court order to access that document. USC had received multiple complaints about Dr. Tyndall dating back to the 1990s, but the school failed to refer him to the state's medical board, according to the report. The Tyndall case is one of the largest sex crimes investigations in Los Angeles police history. More than 650 lawsuits are alleging sexual misconduct by Tyndall, who was allowed to leave his post with a pristine professional record. Harriet Ryan is one of the reporters who's been writing about this for the LA Times, and she joins us now. Harriet, welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Harriet, let's start with how these records came to light. Why did the Times decide to pursue access to documents that had been under seal?
So about 600, 700 women have filed suit against the University of Southern California. And some of those cases are playing out in a federal class action suit in U.S. District Court. And as part of settlement negotiations, USC turned over a number of documents to the plaintiffs to arrive at a settlement number. They also later provided additional documents to the judge for his private review as he decides whether to approve the settlement. The Times made a request. We filed a motion. We believe that these documents should be available for public review. And as the press, we think of ourselves as representatives of public interest. And USC opposed our attempts to get access to these documents. They said that they were, you know, part of a private mediation. They weren't public. Dr. Tyndall opposed us getting access to these documents. But ultimately, U.S. District Court Judge Stephen Wilson sided with us, and he said that there was a public interest in these records coming out, and that it was important not just for people that are interested in George Tyndall and USC in this case, but just for the community in understanding cases where there is sexual misconduct and how big institutions handle them.
Go ahead. Well, in all your reporting, you've revealed a lot of details, quite disturbing ones, about what the doctor is accused of doing. And without being overly graphic, could you tell us what you have found out most recently from these confidential records?
So these records just really add a new level of detail to what we knew when we first broke this story last May. They show their emails, they are memos, they're quick notes between administrators and long detailed reports. And they really demonstrate the level at which Tyndall was a problem within the USC clinic. He was a huge problem there. And the times when those allegations against him of misconduct, some sexual, some not, made it up to the level of the administration. They were brought to the attention of deans or lawyers or HR investigators for on the university. And so I think that's really important. It's not, you know, just sources telling us things anymore. It's not a blanket, you know, apology by USC. It's the actual granular details of who knew what when. And it's a very disturbing account that I think will make a lot of people say, why was this person allowed to remain in what is potentially one of the most sensitive jobs on the entire campus for 27 years?
Did you feel that you learned more about how USC handled the complaints against Dr. Tindall?
Yes. I think I learned that I saw in a lot of Dr. Tindall's responses when students would complain, when colleagues would complain, how he reacted. He was very forceful in his denials. He presents himself as an absolute expert in gynecology who should never be challenged and who knows more than anyone else practicing in the field. And that is very intimidating. You know, my colleague Matt Hamilton and I spent 10 hours with him, and I got a taste for his personality and how he operates, and he comes off very confidently. But in these records, you can see that, you know, a woman would complain, and his response would be a lengthy, single-spaced letter back to his boss explaining why, you know, in his view, there's nothing wrong here. You know, there's nothing to look at. Move on. I know everything. Mm-hmm. And you also see that it's a very rare woman, a very rare student who can fully, who says, this happened to me and it was wrong. And those students tend to, in the records, sometimes they're graduate students who are older, but there's the sense from the clinic staff or from the nursing staff that this is happening to many people, many of the patients, and only some of them, a very small percentage, are making any kind of complaint. And the explanation for that, there's an explanation for that provided in an expert report in 2016, where these medical experts say, you know, the group of women that he's interacting with are extremely vulnerable. They don't have a lot of experience with gynecology. He appears to be really focused on international students from Asia who have a language barrier, who might not even realize the comments he's making and the way he's touching them aren't inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And so that there are probably many people, when we've learned since our story broke, many people have sued USC. And a lot of them say, like, at the time, I had a terrible feeling in my stomach. I told my roommate, I told my mom, but they didn't go and, you know, file a formal complaint with USC.
Harriet, we only have about a minute left, but I want to ask you about the new president coming in this summer, who is a woman. Carol Folt starts July 1st. What changes do you think she'll put into place to prevent things like this from happening again?
Well, nearly all of the university's top administrators have either left voluntarily or been shown the door. So she's really trying to start with a clean slate administratively, bring in people that she trusts and that she feels will kind of help change the culture of the school. It's a tall order at USC, where there have been a number of scandals over the years, and a lot of people are taking a real wait-and-see attitude with her. They want to know and see evidence that she's going to change, that there will be this new culture of transparency and openness where people will feel comfortable speaking up and where doing the right thing will really be the order of the day.
All right. Thank you so much, Harriet. Ryan with the Los Angeles Times for telling us about the report that details the decades of complaints USC received about its gynecologist, Dr. George Tindall. Harriet, thanks for taking the time. And I should also mention that we did reach out to USC for comment, and we were given a statement from Wanda M. Austin, the university's interim president, that says, quote, "We believe that former patients, as well as our USC community, will benefit from the disclosure of this information. The documents show when complaints against Dr. Tindall were made, the nature of the complaints, and the university's response to them. Our hope is that the documents will assist former patients in assessing their legal options, including those who are evaluating whether to remain in the proposed federal class action settlement. These records should help confirm that the proposed settlement remains the best option for bringing a fair and respectful resolution to this matter for as many of Dr. Tindall's former patients as possible. Making changes to strengthen our university, rebuild trust, and healing our community remain our top priorities." More Take Two coming up.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. An online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start in September. Apply by May 28th for a $1,500 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. Now, try Googling the phrase self-defense. What pops up are usually photos and videos that have a common thread: physical moves, specifically for women, to deter attackers. But there is more to self-defense than escaping an attack. What about preventing an attack before it even happens? Nita Lelyveld is a columnist at the LA Times who wrote about a class teaching street smarts. It's called Asphalt Anthropology. She joins me via Skype now. Welcome to Take Two.
Thank you so much, Josie.
And Beverly Baker is the instructor of that class that teaches awareness and mindfulness, and she's with me in studio. Welcome, Beverly.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Nita, in your column, you start out writing that Angelenos are feeling on edge as they walk the streets of this city. Why do you think that is?
It's the way the city looks right now, with all the tents everywhere and a lot of people sleeping on the streets, and people are just feeling anxious about their safety. And I think one of the reasons that I wrote the column was it sort of saddens me when I see all these comments on neighborhood message groups where people are saying, basically, let's get all these people out of our neighborhoods, clumping them together as one big blob, and feeling unsafe because of a whole group of people, most of whom are not threats to them.
So you have this in the back of your mind when you learn about Beverly. So how did you hear about her course?
I came across a mention of Beverly's class. She was talking about street smarts. I just connected the two things in my head. And I thought maybe this kind of decoding of the urban environment that she's teaching can help people be a little less fearful and sort out what they're seeing so that they actually see people again and not just a big threat.
So Beverly, Nita found you, and you had been doing this kind of training for a while. What got you into it? Is there an origin story behind this?
So I've been doing the physical aspect 20 years ago. And then about three-ish years ago, I started feeling like there was a disconnect. As you mentioned in the intro, you know, if you Google what is self-defense, the images that pop up, you know, are all about the physical. And if you think of violence happening on a timeline, and if the middle of that timeline is the event itself, someone puts their hands on you, that kind of thing, what happens before that? And I wanted to decode that and figure that out. Somehow the physical owns the paradigm of self-defense. What if instead we intuition and improvisation and adaptability and mindfulness, just good old mindfulness that we get in yoga.
Being present.
And so, you know, if the situation comes to going hands-on, really nobody wants to go there. So what I've done in this class is, like, what are the specific things that you need to be aware of? What are behaviors that a bad guy would be exhibiting? What are environmental factors that you can be looking out for? And as Nita pointed out, it's not just the clump of, oh, there's tense, you know, I'm going to die in two seconds. You know, it's like, what is specifically happening? A lot of this information is available to law enforcement, to military, to martial artists, but I wasn't really seeing anyone bringing it to communities, like just the average person walking down the street, the person who has to commute, the college student going off to college. And it's really, that's where I wanted to bring this information to.
So, Nita, it doesn't sound like Beverly's class was about teaching martial arts or how to weaponize your car keys. What were you expecting when you first got to her class?
I actually found it to be much as I hoped it would be. First of all, I didn't get to her class until Beverly vetted me on two separate occasions to make sure that I wasn't going to be telling this terrible story about how you should be all frightened in L.A.
Right, because that's not what Beverly's thing is, right? You're all about being an urban explorer and enjoying your surroundings.
If you leave my class more fearful or just as fearful as when you walked in, I've failed in my job. And Nita, I've had other news reach out to me, and I kind of checked it out. And it's like, you know, if you're going to just do a story that's more scary L.A., that's the opposite of what I'm working on. So, like, that's not going to happen. So, yeah, Nita's awesome. And I just appreciated her, the way she tells stories. And it's more nuanced. Mm-hmm. And violence is more nuanced. And those are the nuances we get into in class.
Well, this is the part of the show where it's news you can use. So say I'm on the red line, which you seem to travel a lot. Are there any specific things that people should always be on the lookout for?
Yeah. So the best way, I think, to get into the head of a bad guy is, well, literally to think like a bad guy. If you are wanting to take some money from someone, what are the opportunities that you're going to look for and take advantage of? So just sitting on the red line, okay, I'm a bad guy. Okay, that person, their thing's unzipped. They're looking at their phone. They've got their headphones on and they're never looking up. Now, I'm going to confess, I totally look at my phone on the red line. But I always stop what I'm doing when the doors open and people get on, people get off, and I'm scanning to see who's getting on, who's getting off. I'm looking for that victim profile, and I'm also looking for who could cause trouble. And so as soon as, you know, I feel comfortable and confident, I put my podcast back on, or, you know, I'll check my email again. I'm not glued to it. So I know everyone, it's generally a very black and white advice, like, never look at your phone. It's like, be mindful, practice mindfulness in a public space.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Beverly Baker, who teaches self-defense in L.A., and we also have Nita Lelyveld, columnist for the L.A. Times, who wrote about Beverly's course. Nita, did you feel that having Beverly, a female instructor, that you were able to get insights from her that a man wouldn't be able to offer?
I actually didn't think about it that way, although she's very good at telling people. People constantly ask her in the class, if I'm in this situation, what do I do? And she says, you know, no situation is alike. She doesn't give these kind of pat answers that are, you know, one size fits all, because it's just not, which I thought was important.
Yeah, violence is very personal. You know, someone, so I'm white, but if there's a person of color, they're going to be targeted in a different way. Like, I can get away with yelling at somebody on the street. And, you know, I've talked to some friends of mine who are African American, and, you know, there's that whole idea of angry black woman. And, you know, if I were to say to a black woman, well, just yell at them, I could be making the situation worse. So what we talk about in the class are, what are the dynamics of violence? And now you've, like, put these kind of rules of how violence works into your life, because it would be very unwise and arrogant of me to assume that, you know, oh, you're a person of color, or oh, you're a big guy. Because, like, sometimes somebody just wants to take on a big guy just to prove something.
Do you feel many of us, in our attempt to be polite or gracious, open ourselves to risk?
Especially women. I don't want to just exclude other folks, but especially women, we're socialized to be nice, to get along. We're often punished if we're not. And that's what a bad guy, that's what a predator will count on. He counts on you not wanting to rock the boat, if you will. And so if you are targeted by a bad guy, they may say something to you like, what time is it? Or whatever. Like, it could just be the most innocent thing. But then, like, they keep interviewing you. They keep seeing how far they can get.
Right. And I've been there.
You've been there. Yes. Yeah, exactly. We all have. And, you know, you can just say no and walk away. You can, you know, maybe be a little more aggressive if the situation calls for that. It's all dependent. But if you just stand there and let yourself get interviewed because you're not wanting to be rude or impolite, that is not going to be helpful to you in the situation.
Nita, are you behaving differently out in the world now that you've taken Beverly's class? Are you following your gut more?
I'm seeing so much more because she has reminded me to do things like, I have good eyesight. I can look two blocks ahead of me. I live in Hollywood. I live in a challenging neighborhood where we have a lot of addicts and severely mentally ill people on the streets. And you have to be careful. You have to look. I've always been looking around me, but then she talks about sort of growing your bubble, that you really can look two blocks down and see what's going on there. You don't have to just start noticing when somebody's 10 feet away from you. You can sort of get a preview of your surroundings as you're moving through them. And I find that very helpful.
We've been talking to Nita Lelyveld, columnist for the LA Times, and Beverly Baker, who teaches safety in city living with her asphalt anthropology workshops. Thanks so much to the both of you for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Josie.
Coming up on Take Two, you've got a long weekend ahead of you, but no particular plans. What to do, what to do. Don't worry, we've got ideas upon ideas. Maybe you already know you're headed to an amusement park. We're going to tell you about the latest and greatest in rides. Stay tuned. Back with Take Two, I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. With the long weekend around the corner, we have some ideas to help you plan it out.
Hi, I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. Memorial Day weekend is here, and a supersized weekend means that there's a supersized number of things to do here in SoCal.
Speaking of supersize, to get you up to speed for Godzilla, King of the Monsters, which comes out next Friday, the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood is putting on a Godzilla-thon, showing six of the giant monster movies back-to-back, starring the giant reptilian creature. And that's just a sampling of this film franchise, which has more than 30 films in total.
Wow.
Yeah, this binge watch begins on Saturday at 1 with a 1954 original film, Gojira, followed by lesser-known titles like 1974's Godzilla vs. Mechagodzilla. And I don't know if you're familiar with this premise, but no. It's where the ape-like aliens build a robot Godzilla that may or may not be more powerful than the original monster. Okay. Most of these films are screened in 35mm from rare prints and, except for Gojira, are dubbed in English. And if, by the way, you've only ever seen the first Godzilla movie, the American version with Raymond Burr, Gojira is not just a great monster movie, but a very good movie, period. Tickets for this marathon run between $20 and $25.
And then while Godzilla stomps across the screen, also happening this weekend, catch hundreds of drag queens stomping down the runway. Today through Monday is RuPaul's Drag Con at the LA Convention Center. This is like Comic-Con for fans of the show Drag Race and the art of drag in general. You'll be able to meet and take pictures with some of your favorite queens from past seasons and this current one. I am Team Evie, by the way. Plus, discover new and upcoming drag queens, shop all the cool merch, catch panels from people like comedian Nicole Byer, and more. And here's a bonus. On Monday, there is a special pool party for attendees at the nearby Hotel Figueroa with DJs like JD Sampson. Passes to DragCon range in prices, but they start at $40.
Sunday from 1 to 6 p.m., you can play Mainopoly in Santa Monica with hundreds of other people. So this is a culinary walking tour along Main Street that doubles as an interactive version of the board game. Players exchange Monopoly bucks for tastings at participating restaurants, cafes, ice cream shops, and they work their way around the board to win prizes. This event is all ages and family friendly, so feel free to dress up in Monopoly-inspired or patriotic attire, so bust out those monocles and top hats. Adult tickets start at $25, and there's a VIP option that includes access to the go-to-jail VIP lounge and beer garden.
Finally, we get this long weekend because of Memorial Day. It is a day to remember the servicemen and women who lost their lives for our country. There will be services on Monday in cities like Inglewood, Sylmar, Covina Hills, and more. We have a bigger list on LAist. But you can pay tribute to those fallen Americans by heading to the Battleship Iowa Museum in San Pedro. Starting at 10 a.m., there's going to be a ceremony plus a big community gathering. It'll include patriotic performances from the band US 99, the dance troupe, the San Pedro City Ballet, and more. Plus, food trucks and beer tastings are on site as well. For any of these Memorial Day events, they are free. Now, there's actually so much more to do than just that. You can find our full list of events on LAist.com. That is LAIST.com.
And I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Duran.
Have a good long weekend.
All right, that was fun. Well, let's close out the week with some more fun. Disneyland's Galaxy's Edge opens at the end of the month, offering rides on board the Millennium Falcon and chances to hand-build a lightsaber, design a droid, or sample blue milk. Reservations for the first 3 weeks are, understandably, already sold out. And even though reservations won't be needed as of June 24th, you can be guaranteed that the lines will still be brutal. So what is a theme park fan supposed to do? Well, many other parks also have new rides and experiences opening this summer. Robert Niles has the details. He runs the website Theme Park Insider. Robert, welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks for having me here.
So everyone is so focused on Disneyland, right? Mm-hmm. But there are some other parks out there, too, and they, you know, have a lot of things going on as well. Let's start off with the major new rides you can tell us about.
Well, there's a couple new roller coasters coming to Southern California this summer. One has already opened down in San Diego at SeaWorld. It's called Tidal Twister. It's actually, if you're familiar with the old carnival ride, a Himalaya, it's kind of a figure eight version of that. It's this figure eight that's on the ground, only about 30 feet tall. But when you're crossing in the middle, two trains on it, one side is going upside down and the other is just kind of flying over top of it. So it's got nice weightless moments on top
of
it.
That sounds high concept.
And then at Six Flags Magic Mountain, later this summer, we're getting West Coast Racers, which is a new multi-launch dueling coaster that's coming to the park. It's themed to West Coast Customs, which is the design shop that does a lot of Hollywood show cars. So we don't have an opening date for that yet, but it's coming later.
Okay, so those are the brand new rides, but there's a couple other theme parks that are just updating what they already got, right?
Yeah, Knott's Berry Farm just debuted what they're calling Calico River Rapids. It's the old Bigfoot Rapids ride, but they've added a bunch of animatronics and show scenes to it, just like they did with their Flume ride and the Calico Mine ride a few years back. So it's a really nicely upgraded adventure that they have there. And you get soaking wet.
Well, a lot of people do go to theme parks for rides and to get soaked, but there are also shows where you can enjoy some great performances and stay dry. What are the new shows that are coming to local parks this year?
There is a great new show at Universal Studios Hollywood that we got a taste of over spring break. It's called The Dark Arts at Hogwarts Castle, and it's all dedicated to things Slytherin and dark arts. It's another projection show on the castle, but they also have the first use of light-up drones that we've seen in a Southern California theme park. Oh. It's a really nice little way to cap off that show, and that's coming back in June.
Drones are everywhere, right? Even
Absolutely.
At Hogwarts. What about Legoland down in Carlsbad? I've been meaning to get down there. It's turning 20 this year.
Yes.
Doing anything special for their birthday?
Well, if you have a child, they can get in for free on their birthday all year long at Legoland, California. So that's
that.
The big thing there. And they've got a new 4D movie in their theater down there. But really the big attraction is those free admissions on kids' birthdays this year.
And because you are the theme park insider, because Disneyland's Galaxy Edge is the big news this summer, we have to ask, does it really live up to the hype? Do you know?
Absolutely. It is a lot of fun. I have to say, I had a total fanboy moment there when I went in and I saw Luke's land speeder just floating there in the land. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's just like what I always dreamed of. And, you know, can't wait to get a closer look at it, get on the Millennium Falcon, and get a taste of that blue milk.
Yeah, I have heard from, I have some friends who work at Disneyland who say this is going to be a very emotional experience for, fans of Star Wars. Are you expecting that people are going to have, like, literally meltdowns?
Yeah, when you see the Millennium Falcon for the first time, it is certainly an emotional moment. I mean, a lot of people start to tear up at that point. You would think everyone just gets the phone out and takes a selfie, but it's kind of interesting to see everyone just take a breath for a moment and just look at it and go, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I'm seeing this thing because it is life size. It is all the details. I didn't know the Millennium Falcon had headlamps. It does.
I did not know that either, but I'm not a huge fan. I am more of a Hogwarts fan. Is it going to have as visceral experience for folks?
Yeah, I mean, the difference here is that this is an all-new location. It's not someplace we're familiar with in the Star Wars universe, but that Millennium Falcon is still the Millennium Falcon, and it's something that we've all wanted to see and go on, and we're going to get the opportunity to do that at Disneyland this summer.
All right. Robert Niles is with the Theme Park Insider. We've been chatting about all the new attractions coming to SoCal's theme parks this summer. Plus, of course, Disneyland's Galaxy's Edge. Robert, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That's it for Take Two this week. The show was edited by Sue Carpenter. Our producers are Lori Galaretta and Leo Duran. Austin Cross directed the show. Itzi Quintanilla helped us out this week. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice. The program is engineered by Hazmi Pogosian. Our senior producer is Megan Larson. I'm Josie Huang. We are off Monday for Memorial Day, but we'll be back next Tuesday. Have a great long weekend, everyone.